Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle.
One of the early messages I got before, even before ALS, when I rebooted my life after Christianity, was that we don't remember days, we remember moments, and that life is a collection of moments. And anything we can do as a human being to help another person's moments be better is a win. It's a good day. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes that's all it takes. That's all it really is. I'm here. I'm connecting with another person. Am I making their day better or worse or neutral? If I've got the opportunity to make it better, I'm not changing their life, but they had a better day. And that's a good thing. That's a big thing. And then we string a bunch of those days together, we've got a better life. So that's really all we're doing.
Hello, it is Judy with Wellness Renaissance and the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. I have a great conversation coming up for you today. The voice you just heard was Dave Warnock, and he is, well, I'm going to let him tell you for the most part, but Dying Out Loud is the tour he's on and the entity and concept that he has created since being diagnosed with ALS about a year ago. And his journey has really taken off from there, which you will hear. It's all about looking at life in the face, or in his case, the end of it, and having some idea when it's going to happen. And what do you do with that information? And he has created this wonderful thing that he is spreading around that is really helping people in a very real way. I found out about Dave from a friend of the podcast who sent me his information and said, hey, you got to check this guy and what he's doing out. This is something you'd be very interested in. And I'm absolutely intrigued by the work he's doing and his journey for many reasons. And I wanted to share him and his journey with you guys, my audience. So I reached out to him and here we are. I just so appreciate his down-to-earth, realistic, very grounded and tangible message. And even if you don't believe the exact same way that he does, I think there's a lot you can take with you. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
I am truly excited to have you here. I think the conversation is so huge and so important, and you're one of the unique people in the world, I think, that can really have it from a very personal perspective. So let's talk about what that is. I'll give your history a little bit and you can fill in the holes.
Okay.
You were a pastor for 37 years. And talk about the sect that you were a pastor in, because I think that's pretty important.
Yeah, I was, to clarify that, I was a Christian, an evangelical charismatic Christian for 37 years. The pastor part was off and on through those years. I was oftentimes on staff at churches. Other times I was a lay leader, had my own businesses, that sort of thing. So it was not a straight line pastoral ministry kind of thing that some people might think of.
Okay. And then you left the church.
Yes.
And then you were very recently, a year ago or so, right, diagnosed with ALS.
Correct.
So talk about that a little bit, because here's what came to mind when I first heard that. So I, just to give you a little bit of my background, I grew up in a Missouri Synod Lutheran church.
Yeah.
And have, I don't know exactly what I call myself, but I, after studying Christianity, I realized it just didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. But my thought was hearing your path is, how many people have said to you, well, you left the church and then you got diagnosed with ALS. So is that a punishment thing? Like, to me, from my experience, that would be the logical conclusion.
Well, no one has said that to me to my face.
Okay.
They may have said it privately or to one another. The timeline on that wouldn't really work, because I've been an atheist for going on 10 years now.
Okay.
And only recently. So if God was punishing me, he sure took his time getting around to it.
Make that stop. So, right. Definitely not a direct response.
Right.
So talk a little bit about leaving the church, and then I want to talk about a little more on what the focus is of what you're doing right now.
Yeah, the leaving Christianity behind was a process that took a year or two for me to discover, in that I began a process of evaluation and study and thought, primarily the beginning of 2009, and by the end of 2010. Well, no, that's not correct. I began the process of questioning probably in 2010, and by 2011, midway through there, I had come to the end of my faith and really couldn't make sense of it anymore. I really looked at how the Bible was constructed and what it was and what it wasn't. My kind of faith was very interactive with God. He was very present, very involved, entered prayer, directed us. Everything was about God's will, what God is saying. And so that God, coming to the conclusion after a while that God just really didn't show up and wasn't present and wasn't active and wasn't involved and was very quiet and hidden and invisible, that realization came to me that I was just doing all this on my own.
So that was kind of the piece that sort of led you into the questioning?
Yeah, well, that was the result of the questioning. Okay. That I wasn't seeing God showing up anywhere, never had. And looking back through my life as a Christian, I saw that things happened to Christians and to non-Christians just the same. They got cancer, they got sick, they were killed in car wrecks. Prayers weren't answered. Things didn't happen differently according to think of Christians being blessed by God and living a better life. There was no evidence for that. And after taking a hard look at that, essentially I quit making excuses for God's poor behavior, which I'd done my whole life. And you have to do that as a Christian. You have to excuse God. Well, you know, he's just having a bad day, or he's grumpy today, or he's busy somewhere else, or whatever, you know.
The reasons you cannot understand the reasons that God wouldn't do that. So that's beyond your understanding.
His ways are higher than ours. Yep. And yeah, mm-hmm. After a while that just gets old and exhausting. So I just said, you know what? I'm done.
So now you're in this place and the work that you're doing, Dying Out Loud, is a result of your diagnosis of ALS and having your life path, I imagine, completely shifted to that sort of realization that you've been given that you have a limited amount of time left and you know more what that is than most of us do, right?
Yeah.
So when you got that diagnosis, because I've heard a few people's stories about getting their diagnosis, that it was very cold and very unsettling, and they were kind of sent away with no information and no guidance, and they just kind of had to figure this out themselves. Was that your experience? And what kind of like went through your head and in this process of getting that diagnosis?
Yeah, that was very much my experience. And neurologists aren't the warmest, fuzziest doctors around. So yeah, it was just a cold clinical diagnosis, and I was sent on my way to die. There's no cure. There's no treatment. There's just a time frame you're given of 3 to 5 years. And they have a clinic that you can go to, which basically consists of tests to see how you're progressing. You go every few months. I haven't gone in a while because there's really no point in it. There's nothing they can do for you. So, you know, I just haven't wanted to spend the time for them to tell me, yeah, you're losing strength in your arms. I can tell that without you telling me that. Mm-hmm. And they help you with things like therapy and adjusting and strengthening what you have and help with equipment as you need it and those sorts of things. So they're helpful in that sense, but they're essentially managing your death with you, for you. And, you know, I understand if there's not a cure, there's no reason to spend a lot of time thinking about other things. It's just, you know, how can we help you and make it better, easier for you, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you've taken this opportunity. So we'll talk about the difference of, you know, your experience of going through this dying process in a very aware way now versus maybe how you would have thought about it as a Christian and how you would have processed it as a Christian.
Well, the main difference in the processing this as a Christian, as opposed to a secular person, an atheist or humanist, is what one believes happens after death. The Christian believes that, at least my version of Christianity, what I would consider biblical Christianity, believes that or teaches that this life is a dress rehearsal for eternal life, and that the closer we walk with God in this life, the better we will be rewarded in eternity. And that was our understanding of heaven and hell, is that, yeah, if you pray the sinner's prayer and you're born again, you will go to heaven when you die. So the idea of that following, the life that follows that, is that the more you do for God in this life, the more crowns you'll have, the more jewels you'll have in your crown in heaven, the bigger mansion you'll get, the closer seat to God or whatever. There's different iterations of that, but the idea exists that the more you do for God's kingdom in this life, i.e. winning souls or helping people or whatever you're doing for God in the kingdom, then when you die, you'll be rewarded accordingly. In other words, a person who prays a sinner's prayer never does anything beyond that, never helps his people, never does anything, never even goes to church, never reads their Bible, just didn't do shit. They'll still get into heaven, but they'll have a cot in the basement of heaven. Whereas the missionary who laid his life down his whole life will have a big mansion in heaven. There's that idea that floats throughout evangelicalism, mm-hmm. which is just on the face, is just preposterous. The whole idea of that is just, the whole idea of heaven and hell as a whole is just ridiculous.
It's hard to take, right? I think I saw something that you had talked about where, I don't remember which two people you were talking about, you know, this person, even though they did horrible things all their life, but because they said the right words on their dying breath, they're going to heaven. But this other person who did magnificent, treated humanity in a wonderful way, didn't accept Jesus and therefore go.
Yeah, there's right? The contrast I made in a talk, and it's been repeated a few times, is the idea, according to evangelical theology, Ted Bundy's in heaven and Anne Frank is in hell, or to use another person, Mahatma Gandhi is in hell. Mm-hmm. Although he liberated India and helped countless people, Ted Bundy was a mass murderer, but he prayed the sinner's prayer, so he goes to heaven. Mm-hmm. So if I was a Christian, I would get to hang out with Bundy in heaven, whereas poor little Anne Frank or Mahatma Gandhi, They're in hell burning because they didn't believe the right things about Jesus.
Yeah, that is very hard to take. I think that's part of the challenge that I had when I was growing up in the Lutheran church, of just trying to figure out, I don't even know what the right thing is to do. I feel like there's so much, you know, I'm not right. Sure. And I was told in confirmation class that I had committed the unforgivable sin and therefore I was going to hell anyway. So I'm like, well, I got a free pass. I can do whatever I want.
Well, live it up.
I know, right? I have not done so many things that I should be doing to take advantage of that.
Yeah.
But this diagnosis for you was this sort of, you're looking at life, the time you have, in such a different way. And though I understand that that might come with anybody dying, from everything that I'm hearing that you're saying, is part of the freedom in that is that you aren't living in the Christian faith.
Right. No, I'm living as a secular person, as an atheist who believes that death is it. We have this one life. And that's the difference that I've seen, the contrast that I've drawn. My Christian friends and family that I did the same. I believed that the life that really mattered was eternal life, and this life was secondary. And if you think that way, then you're going to minimize the benefits of this life. You're going to minimize the beauty in a sunset, the power in a day, the awesome interaction we have with humans. That's going to be secondary. Whereas if you believe that this life is the only one we have, then you're going to make the most of the moments if you really believe that. And so that's what I talk about in Dying Out Loud, is what are we doing with the life we know we have? Mm-hmm.
It's sort of that different perspective of that I'm really understanding. I co-host some death cafes.
Yeah.
And it's so amazing to sit down with people who want to talk about this, you know, and who some people are like, I'm not really comfortable talking about this, but I know that I need to. And that discussion, that's a common theme of when we kind of get this acceptance around death, and get a little more comfortable with it, that our life, the meaning of our life and the meaning of our moments and how we think about this life somehow takes on a different, more meaningful and maybe a more bold shape.
It does. If you focus on it in the right way, it does. Maury Schwartz, who the book Tuesdays with Maury was about, he said a powerful thing, but he had ALS, by the way, that's what he died of. And he said, you can't, I may be misquoting it, but until you learn how to die, you cannot learn how to live. And so what he means is, until you come to terms with your mortality and the finality of this life, you're going to miss what there is in this life that would otherwise, you're going to miss the moments that you have and the opportunities you have because you're not coming to terms with the finality of the days we have. We're all, in a sense, terminal. We're beginning from the moment we're born, we're beginning to die. Mm-hmm. And so once we come to terms with that and quit running from that and quit being afraid of it and quit denying it, then we just accept it for what it is. It's dying is nothing more than the natural result of living. And so it's nothing to be afraid of. It's nothing to run from. It's nothing to hide from. We don't talk about it because it's mysterious, it's final, and it's an uncomfortable idea to embrace. Mm-hmm. But once we do embrace it, then it sets you free. Okay, I've accepted that. That's going to happen. Now, what am I doing with today, with tomorrow, with next week, with next year? What am I allowing to happen to me versus what am I making happen?
Mm-hmm. Talk about ALS in specific. Some people may be familiar with that, some not, but talk about what that looks like for you. I know you mentioned that you're losing strength in your arms and it's kind of this process.
Mm-hmm. Well, if more people refer to it as Lou Gehrig's disease, it's a amyolateral sclerosis. I can't say the first word. And it's essentially the nerves in your body quit communicating with the muscles. And so the muscles atrophy and you lose strength in either your arms or your legs or your mouth area. One of those usually is attacked first and then the others follow in random, unpredictable order. So mine has been in my arms and hands. That's when I first noticed things. And it's been gradually, very good. Mine's moving very slowly, which I'm thankful for, but I don't know where it's going to go next. It's either going to attack my legs and I'll lose the ability to walk, or it'll attack my mouth and I won't be able to talk and swallow and things like that. Mm. Eventually it goes to your diaphragm and your lungs then don't quit working and you die from that. It's a very horrible disease in the way that it ends. It's not painful per se, but it's just you lose. You know, we talk about it. It stands for always losing something. You just continue to lose functionality, lose independence, lose the ability to do things for yourself, and you become more and more dependent on people around you. So it affects a lot of people when you're dealing with this.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, listening to you saying that, and the final days of that, even though it's not necessarily painful, that to me sounds frightening. Like, Greg, the death aspect of it isn't so frightening. The process of dying to me sounds frightening in just the physical and what you're going to experience there.
Yeah, and I think that's true of any way that we die. The act of death itself is nothing to be concerned about. You simply quit breathing. You the lights go out, and you don't feel or see or think anymore. And so then you're done, you're gone. And the people around you then have to pick up the pieces, and that's the aftermath, and that's the difficult part of it. Mm-hmm. The process that ALS projects on the body is that you become more and more immobilized and more non-functional. And so that, to me, is the worst part of it. Like you said, the idea of going to sleep and not waking up is not that troublesome for me personally, mm-hmm. because then you're not going to be aware that you didn't wake up.
Right.
So, you know, there's nothing to be concerned about there, but the process of everything having been done for me for years or for months is disconcerting. And so I'm not a person who's going to be, I'm going to take matters into my own hands before we get to that point. I don't know what the line is that I'll draw, but I'll draw a line where I'll say, this is enough. I'm not going to do any more.
Can you talk about that a little more? Because I think that is something, you know, I think of the Dying with Dignity and the Atul Gawande book, which I can't think of the name of off the top of my head, that kind of talks about where does life end and then what do you do about that? Because I think I think it's a conversation that and I know because I'm doing the Death Cafe and things like that, I open up myself to a lot more conversations with people who right. feel like, okay, I can talk to you about this. Of that, because I know for me personally, you know, I think of that process and I haven't read The Final Exit, which I've been told that's a book I need to read, that talks about, you know, the rights around that we don't really have in this country. And I really don't know what people have overseas either. But to me, I want us to have more rights to say, I'm done now. And I know people are fearful of that being used improperly against people who don't want it. And I make sense of that.
Sure.
I feel like a lot of it, it's always felt like there's something else underlying it. And I know part of it is from what I hear from Christians or religious people, is, well, you know, it's not okay to play God, right? It's to make that decision for yourself. And that doesn't make sense to me because we have people in hospitals all the time who are on machines where God has already said, dude, I'm calling you home, but somebody else is interfering here.
Well, the notion that you can't play God is completely ridiculous when you consider the fact that the very people who will say that, if they get cancer, they'll go get chemo, or mm-hmm. they'll go hook up to a machine somewhere, or they'll get surgery of some kind. I mean, if a Christian says you can't play God, and now I know there are extremist Christians who don't even do medicine at all, and we're not talking about them. We're talking right. about mainstream Christianity that says you can't end your life on your own terms if you're terminally ill. Would at the same time, if they had a tumor in their body, they would go get that thing cut out. Well, you're playing God right there, mm-hmm. because to not do that, if you're saying that you're only going to let happen what happens and that God's in charge of everything, then you never go to the hospital. You'd never go to a doctor. You wouldn't take any measures to prolong your life at all or to make yourself better. So that's ridiculous at the outset. The idea, so that's the undercurrent about against this dignity death thing that we're talking about. I don't know if you've heard of the Final Exit Network.
Not the network, I don't think.
Yeah, there's an organization called Final Exit Network.
Okay.
I work with them in official capacity. They reached out to me a few months ago after hearing a podcast because I found out about the group a year ago and I started talking about it as my option or my preferred option for myself personally. And so someone heard a podcast and contacted me, and then I've been in touch with the executive director and the president, and they want me to kind of be a spokesperson and kind of work with them in an official capacity to get the word out that this is available. Cause a lot of people like yourself don't know about it. And essentially it helps you end life on your own terms anywhere. You don't have to live in a state. It's might surprise you, but it's not illegal to kill yourself because they can't arrest you, right?
if you succeed, right?
Right. It is illegal to help someone do that. So that's the difference.
Right, right.
So this organization helps you put things in place legally, medically, financially, helps you with equipment, how to do it, when to do it, counseling, all the things that one might need to make an informed decision and to help you in the actual process itself. I mean, they will actually send a volunteer to meet with you in your home, whatever state you live in. They're an incredible organization, and it's completely nonprofit, volunteer run. You have a counselor or an agent or whatever. I'm not sure exactly the reference. I need to find that out if I'm going to be official with them, right? but you call them on the phone. I've got a person that I call and talk to. When the time is right, you do the paperwork, you do whatever you need to do, but it helps the person have control. And that's what this is about. This is about control. I'm not going to let someone else dictate that part of my life, because that is a part of my life. The ending of it is a part of my life, and I get to decide what that is and when that is.
Right. You know, I have to tell you, sitting here listening to that just like drains tension from my body.
Good.
I just, I have such a, well, I think it's such a fascinating thing that, you know, we can decide when we're going to have children and decide somebody else's, we're going to bring somebody else's life into the world, but we can't say to them, or we can't let them say, you know what, I'm miserable.
Sure.
And I don't want to do this anymore. And I think, you know, I just, to me, there's something I think sort of magical and wonderful and beautiful about that, to say, I am going to talk to, you know, I don't know, to me, it draws a different line around things that has this ability to be comfortable and reach out and almost, I don't know, exciting is the wrong word, but I can imagine if I was in that state and being like, okay, you kind of get your final orders.
Yeah, it's a relief. I know what you're saying. It's a relief to know that I get to control that. And again, I think that the idea of the resistance toward this idea is primarily religious. I believe there is some financial issues going on in this country because a lot of money is made by hospitals and doctors and big pharmacy mm-hmm. to keep people alive a long time because, you know, they're having to do all these things medically. But primarily religion is always about control, and they want to control how your life ends and when it ends. And that is not theirs to control. It's mine to control. It's yours.
Right.
So the idea of, and there are people who will use this organization and get steps in place and get everything in order and never even use it.
Mm-hmm.
But just the idea of knowing that they have that choice, they have that control, is very comforting. It's a relief.
Right.
So that's what it's about. If you want to look it up, in fact, if you work with death cafes, I would recommend that every death cafe have access to their information. Just look up, I'm looking to make sure I got, it's finalexitnetwork.org.
Okay.
And that's it's a great organization. They're very they're just trying to get the word out to more people that there are some options available to people that people just don't even know about. I was going to say we have a link to it on my website, but they're redoing their website, and so that link is not up yet, but okay. It will be because I really want to promote their services. And again, like you said at the outset of this part of the conversation, that anything that we're dealing with that has life and death consequences can be misused and abused.
Right.
I mean, people die in car wrecks every day. And so there are laws and safety measures in place, but we haven't quit driving. We just have to regulate it. We have to monitor it. We have to do the best we can to make it safe for everyone. But the same thing about something like this kind of choice in ending our lives. Yeah, there are ways it can be abused and misused. There are people that can use it the wrong way for the wrong reasons. Yes, that is all true, but none of that negates the real fact that it's a service that people need to have available.
Right. And I think, you know, to your point too, there is misuse about keeping people alive.
Absolutely.
Too long as well. You know,
all of us have known family members, relatives, whatever, they're saying, I'm ready to go. I want to go. I'm suffering. I'm not going to get better. I'm never going to get out of this hospital. I'm never going to get out of this nursing home. Why do y'all insist on keeping me around for another year? I don't want to be here. Mm-hmm. All of us have run into that over and over again in our families, family members, friends, whatever. And the fact that we don't allow that, I mean, we're more compassionate to our pets than we are to our people.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And I've heard so many stories about people who somebody is on life support for years and years because of some weird legal thing that didn't happen and now they can't deal with it. And,
yeah.
You know, and I, you know, I hate to look at the world as the money making, you know, the hospital's making money and then that's where, you know, you want to think good of those people. But at the same time, it's like, look, it's a business and it's so disconnected from the people actually making the money and the people having to do the job and living the experience that they don't even connect anymore. I mean,
right.
I had a family member in the hospital and they basically said to me, not to her, but to me, they basically said, well, no, we want her out of here because we don't want her to die here. We were happy if she spends time here, but we'd like her to die somewhere else because it's not good for our numbers.
And I thought, my God.
That's the most honest thing somebody has like ever said to me in a hospital.
Yeah, no, that's true.
And it's like, you know, it's exact when you start to really get that and understand, like you're saying, it's about your autonomy and you're being able to have control. And there's, you know, I understand the preciousness of life, and I don't want to take that away from anybody. But like you're saying, the amount of, a friend of mine is a retired pastor, and he would do work with hospice. And he talked about a person that he went to go visit. And the person said to my friend, "Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you're here, because I want to talk about death. And I can't, because my family keeps saying, 'Oh no, you're going to be fine. You're going to be fine.'" He's like, "I'm in hospice. I'm dying. Let's get it."
Well, there's this suspension of reality. People don't like to think about it and talk about it because it is so final, and they'd rather pretend that it's not going to happen. And it's just, it doesn't do anyone any good to think that way. Now, there's nobody that loves life more than me. I try to wring everything I can out of every day, and I'm making plans. I mean, that's why we're traveling all over and talking and doing meetings and traveling the world literally. And I'm going to keep doing everything I can to get to live a full, I mean, I'm going to take scuba diving lessons. And why would someone with a terminal illness take scuba diving lessons? What's the point of that? The point of that is that I'm going to keep living every day to the fullest, because that's what life is. And I'm not going to just sit down and, okay, well, I'm dying, I guess I'll sit down and wait to die. No, that's ridiculous. So but on the flip side of that, I'm at peace with it. I know it's coming. I don't know when, I don't know how long. I'm hoping it's longer than they projected. And so far it's showing that it's going to be, and I'm very happy about that. But I want to know that I've got the control and the ability to make decisions at the end, so that when it does come to where I can't do the things that provide me with a quality of life that I'm comfortable with, that I have options. And that's all this is. Mm-hmm. This is not saying, well, life sucks and I want out. That's not what this is.
Right.
That's not what it is at all. And I know some people have that thought. I know there's people with depression, mental illness. Mm-hmm. I'm very aware that if we just take the lid off of things and say, well, let's just make it so that anybody can kill themselves anytime they want and everything's cool. No, that's not what we're saying at all. Mm-hmm. And so anybody that says, well, you're going down that slippery slope. Yeah, it can be a slippery slope, but it's still a slope that needs to be navigated.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and you, I mean, I don't know if lucky is the right word, but I think what you're saying and listening to you and how you're living your life, this awareness of this timeline, you're probably living a more fuller life than many people who live many years longer than you.
Well, that lucky is an okay word. You can't say blessed because that's so Christian. I'm not going to allow that. But no, I've said that many times in my talks and podcasts that I've been given a little bit of a gift here, in the sense that we all have a ticking clock. And the difference between yours and mine is mine sits out on the table. I look at it every day because I mm-hmm. wake up every day and I see my body and what's happening to it. I feel it every day. And so I have the ability to focus on things and not lose track of what life is and what life isn't, and not get caught up in the mundane and the trivial. Whereas some people who are just where death is such an uncertain fixture somewhere out there might not have the advantage of being able to micro focus like I do. Mm-hmm. Now I still get caught up in trivial things and I still get frustrated with the mundane or whatever, but on the whole, I'm looking at life differently than most people do because of this diagnosis. And so what I'm finding as I talk about this over the last year, it's been almost a year now since we've been doing Dying Out Loud. And the thing I hear over and over and over again from people is how my message has allowed them to refocus in ways that they may not have before. And that's really gratifying to me that I get this opportunity, this platform to say these things that are making a difference in people's lives.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, really, you would not have to do this, right? Like, you are doing great work by giving of yourself this way, for people to be able to have this and be able to kind of watch the process that you go through what you're doing and get the message, right? That you could just live your life. And
yeah. And there's a balance there. My girlfriend who I live with, we've talked about that recently, because this Dying Out Loud thing is just, it's kind of all consuming. It's what I do every day. I talk about it all the time. It's really harder on her because she has to hear me talking about dying all the time.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
you know, she goes to meetings with me and it's all about that and the Q&A and people talking to her by herself and talking about her boyfriend dying. And, you know, so I get that it's more difficult for those around me than it is actually for me. And so in that sense, we're having to learn how to balance the life, the normal life that we can try to have with this dying out loud life. And so even in our travels, we're trying to make sure we have time for sightseeing and touristing and not just going and talking at another group. And even when we're not traveling, to make sure we're spending time doing things that I hate to say normal people do, but this thing that we're doing, this life that I'm living, is so far outside the realms of normal that that's kind of how we refer to it now, that we don't get to do normal things. And so we try to make sure that we do that and that we do focus on just living life and enjoying things and not be always talking about dying and living and doing this stuff. But yeah, it does affect what I'm doing and how I'm doing life. It changes my perspective on things. I don't have to be doing it. I could just be trying to live a normal life. But to me, that is a little more depressing than getting up and having this to do every day, because this energizes me in a strange way. It gives me a meaning and purpose to pour myself into, rather than just living life for myself as long as I can and then watching it expire.
It's just so interesting because there's feels like there's just so many dichotomies in all of that you just said, right? Like the whole statement of, like you said, this is harder on her than it is for me. And I think I totally can make sense of that. But I think it's a fascinating thing to think about because you're the one who is dying. And I think that's the thing that I think about if we struggle with that concept, can we sit with ourselves and think about that? Because in many times, like you're saying, when people who are saying, no, I'm ready to go, it's the family that wants to keep them around, and probably because they want to have them around, which totally right. And then the other thing is just like you say, the idea of dying is just so uncomfortable that we can't even just face that.
Yeah. I mean, that's in and of itself, that final exit, as we said, I'm the one that gets to go. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that deal with the repercussions of that. Mm-hmm. Missing me, moving on without me, that kind of thing. Not just her, but close friends that I have and other family members. You know, Dave's not here anymore and we miss Dave. We wish he was here because he was a fun guy. All those things.
Right.
And so I get that. And in that sense, it really hurts me. That part is the hardest for me. Because people will miss me. And I'll be gone. I won't be aware that they're missing me. I won't be aware that I'm missing out on things, but they will be. And so that's why I think people don't like to talk about death, is like family members that say, no, you're going to be fine. Well, no, you're not. You're dying. But they want to pretend that everything's going to go on as normal. Right. Because when that one life stops, the person whose life stopped is done. But the ones who are still there have to go on without them. And they want to try to ignore that if they can, or try to deny that if they can. And that's the struggle, I think.
Right. And I think until, in my own experience and talking to people that I have, until you have had the experience of being able to help somebody plan their death or be with them in the process of dying, you maybe don't get to know kind of what a gift that is.
Right. Yeah. No, it's a very real way to help people in the real world.
Yeah. I mean, I think of the work that death doulas are doing and all of that. I think it is a beautiful thing. And I think it really does. I mean, you know, when I think of my stressed out days, and I have some physical issues that are nothing like you're going to go through. I just have no idea what mine come from. Some sort of fibromyalgia-y kind of thing, but nobody really knows. And I think of just sometimes when I'm feeling really horrible and there is that idea of, you know, I don't have a diagnosis, so I probably would never qualify for anything until mm-hmm. I had some sort of diagnosis. But when I think of that, when I feel horrible and my body is just not working with me, I think, my God, if I knew that I could control my out when, if, you know, there are the days when it's bad and you're like, if this is it, if this is all there is for the rest of my life, this is no fun.
Yeah.
And the peace that comes over my mind when I think of, if I had a choice, if this is all there really is, and at some point I could say, you know what, all right, I'm done. I want to be out of here, and then go forth. Yeah, like you said, there's that freedom and that way that you perceive, and it's how do you bring that perception into your daily living as you're going forward, living, trying to pay the bills, also trying to appreciate the sunsets and create that live as you're dying, but then live as you also have to live. You know.
Yeah. It's a juggle. You have to juggle all of that and try to keep things in perspective and prioritize and all those things.
Right. So I want to talk too about just one of the things that you have on your website, or that I was hearing about, was your bracelets.
Yeah.
Tell me about the origin of that and what they are, because that just made me laugh.
Yeah, everything that's happened in the past year has just been very organic. Nothing was planned out. I didn't sit down with a marketing team and do a strategy session. Everything just kind of happened, and we just kind of went with it. So in Nashville, where I used to live, we have a very vibrant, large community of ex-Christian atheists, people who've come out of evangelicalism, and we've gathered with our like-mindedness and done community together. And so We meet once a month, and so we just kind of talk about what's going on in life. We check in. We just be with each other. And the meeting that followed my diagnosis, a week or two after my diagnosis, everybody was processing how they were dealing with that, because it was a very emotional meeting, lots and lots of heavy emotion in the room. And people were sharing about what their thoughts were around hearing my news, and it was just a heavy meeting. And one of the women in the group, she does jewelry, makes bracelets as a hobby, and as a little business on the side. And so she was just talking about her day one week, the week of, and she was having a frustrating day and getting caught up in anxieties and stress. And she just kind of caught herself and stopped and thought, you know, Dave is dealing with this monster that just jumped on his back, and he wouldn't be all stressed out about this thing I'm stressed out about. What am I doing? Just calm down or whatever. And someone else in the room said, yeah, what would Dave do? And then another person said, yeah, WWDD. And then she said, well, I guess we're going to have bracelets. And so it was a takeoff of the WWJD, what would Jesus do? And now people say I'm equating myself with Jesus, and maybe I am. I don't know.
Wow.
No, it was kind of a thing that took off. And so we started selling them on our website, and people started hearing the message of that. And it was people get them and wear them to remind themselves to focus on what's important in life. That's pretty much it. Mm-hmm. You look down at your bracelet and you say, just, you know, you're stuck in traffic and you're getting stressed out, and you look down at your bracelet and you say, you know what, just chill out. It's a good day. I'm doing fine. I'm healthy. I'm alive. And let me refocus things here. And that's what it's about. And so it's one of those things that's just kind of mind blowing when I get pictures from people around the world who bought bracelets and they're wearing them in Paris, France, or Australia, or England, or whatever. And I'm thinking, okay, this is weird.
Right.
I had a guy send me a picture that he'd done a tattoo on his arm, WWDD.
Oh, wow. That's dedication.
Yeah, he didn't want to just mess with the bracelets, so he just tattooed it on his wrist.
Oh, that's funny. Oh my gosh. Well, it's an interesting thing. And I, you know, I have my personal struggles in processing through my Christianity experience, etc. But I think about the WWJD, because I kind of thought, I mean, when I first heard of that years ago, I was like, that's kind of a cool, like, I like that touchstone. It's kind of a neat touchstone. But then I learned more and struggle with that a bit. And then I look at, you know, so much of our world of of just kind of how things are going and saying, well, nobody's really following the what would Jesus do.
Right.
So I had to laugh when I heard about your bracelets, but I thought, you know, that is actually also, it's funny that can, I don't know if funny is the right word, but it's interesting to me that people can latch on to that. But I think it's something that we are processing through as people, and it's real and it's tangible, and we can hear what you're going through and we can process that. So it's a lovely touchstone, I think.
Yeah. And then after following that, we developed a whole thing where we have t-shirts and coffee mugs and all kinds of things that people can get. There was a guy in Oregon that reached out to me after hearing me on a show, and he's dealing with stage 4 cancer. And he sent me a lovely letter and how he appreciated what I was saying, and it inspired him and it caused him to really focus on what's important. And, you know, just I've gotten literally dozens, hundreds of messages like that from people all over the world. And then at the end of his letter, he said, I loved your message so much, I went and got one of your t-shirts. And he had a picture of himself with a WWDD t-shirt on. What would Dave do? And I said to Maria, my manager, I said, well, do we have t-shirts? And she said, no, we don't. And turns out he'd gotten on the internet and found a WWDD t-shirt and ordered it thinking it was mine.
Oh, wow.
And so I thought, well, I guess we need t-shirts. So we started doing t-shirts with designs on them. And what would Dave do? Carpe the fucking diem, which is another phrase that we use a lot. And dying out loud. And so we have these images you can get on the website and order t-shirts. You can order coffee mugs, blankets, everything you can think of. You can put an image on it. And it's another way for people to support us, to help cover our travel costs and things like that. And also helps them remember what's important. You know, when you're wearing a t-shirt and you're thinking about life and your day and how, what's going on in your life, it's just a touchstone, like you said, to refocus, reprioritize, to manage your life a little better. And it's just one of those small ways. You know, I one of the early messages I got before ALS, when I rebooted my life after Christianity, was that we don't remember days, we remember moments, and that life is a collection of moments. And anything we can do as a human being to help another person's moments be better is a win. It's a good day. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes that's all it takes. That's all it really is. I'm here, I'm connecting with another person. Am I making their day better or worse? Or neutral. If I've got the opportunity to make it better, I'm not changing their life, but they had a better day. And that's a good thing. That's a big thing. And then we string a bunch of those days together, we've got a better life. So that's really all we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you never know when you might be changing somebody's life, right? Like that, sometimes those little moments can be so huge.
Yeah, it can make a difference. It can change the way that they're looking at life. I got another letter from a woman who was dealing with a severe depression, and she said she hadn't gotten out of her house in a year, couldn't walk across the room without a cane, and stumbled upon one of my shows and started listening to my stuff and taking to heart what I was saying about the beauty of life and the value of moments. And she said, today I walked 5 miles, and you know, just it changed how she looked at her life. It opened her eyes to some things. That's a mind-blowing thing to me, but it's a very real help for people in very real ways.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's huge for her. I mean,
huge
for her. Yeah. That's life, right? That's yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Wow. I want to ask you, do you have any, I mean, all of what you are saying is something that we can all kind of take in and figure out what it means to us and how we can sort of use that as a springboard or just let it sink in and see how to take that forward. Do you have anything specific that you can share or for people to think about as, you know, whether it is doctors as they give, you know, diagnosis to people or people kind of just trying to process through maybe something that's happening to them where they're kind of in this shift of maybe as they get older or a true diagnosis that they can take with them and think about? And I know those are two very different questions, but.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have a program or a recipe for any of this. Okay. For me, it's just about taking time as much as you can in the midst of a day or a week or a life to refocus. And we all need to do that from time to time. We need to take a deep breath and ask yourself. The thing I talk about a lot with people is ask yourself the question, are you living the life you want to live? If you're not, whose fault is that? Who has the ability to change that? Well, the obvious answer is me. I'm the captain of my own ship. For a lot of people I talk to are coming out of fundamentalism, and that's the audience that mostly I have, and that was the water I swam in. And that message is that you are not your own, that you are subject to a Lord and Savior, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. Your life is not your own. You can't make your own decisions. You're subject to him. You're basically a pauper, and the king calls the shots. Mm-hmm. Well, that message is gone. That truth is gone. The new truth is I'm the captain of my own ship. I'm the one that has the pen. I'm writing my own story. How do I want that story to go? How do I want it to end? Once we realize we're in charge, once we realize we're autonomous, we have control, then we have to get about asking ourselves, how do I want to do this? And it's not that we isolate each other or isolate from one another. We live in community. So a lot of our conversations are about how are you doing it? How am I doing it? How are we doing it? What's going on in you? What are the obstacles that are keeping you from writing your own story? And as we talk with other people, we allow ourselves to refocus on those areas and sharpen the pen, so to speak, so that we're doing a better job of controlling our own lives. And that's really all we're talking about here. And yeah, we're going to have frustrations. We're going to have obstacles. We're going to have things that come up that want to derail us. But again, we just look inside. We look to ourselves. We look to the power that we each have within us to pull through that, because we do have that. Now, we do need help from other people. We need help from professionals. We need medication at times. We need different things. But at the end of the day, I'm in charge. And it takes many Christians, ex-Christians, a long time to come to that realization and allow themselves the liberty to say that and to acknowledge that and to quit being afraid of that and embrace it. Yeah, that means if I fuck up, I'm the one that has to bear the consequences. But also, when I do well, then I can congratulate myself. And that's a big thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I think about all of the teachings that I had growing up. And I think I'm still working my way out of them today.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It takes time. Yeah, it takes time.
Yeah. It does. You get a lot of, like you say, you're kind of like, it's, well, will God allow this? And so you kind of feel like you can never really succeed, and it's never really, it's you doing the work, you know. You can't say the devil made me do it, but you also can't really say that you did anything well either.
Yeah, no, you can't. You're limited in that, and it's very debilitating, and it really keeps us with a very negative self-image.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you also get the message of, well, God helps those who help themselves, which honestly you don't hear very often.
Yeah.
But it's like, how does all of that live in my head? I can't deal with it, you know? I mean, and I think that for me was the challenge. I think I had this sort of internal explosions of, I don't know. I deal with that when I think about learning about, you know, walking through the spirituality aspects of things too. It sometimes is very similar. There's a lot of conflicting ideas that really you sit there and go, I don't even know how to operate in the world. And so though I still haven't figured out where I land, I totally understand where you're saying on the atheist level of, it is what it is. So move on.
Well, and yeah,
forward.
That's right. Life makes a lot more sense and is a lot simpler when you take the God factor out of it and just do, life just happens, you know. That's the thing that's different when you get a diagnosis like mine. As a Christian, you have to try to figure out where God is in it. What's God saying? What's the will of God? As an atheist, I just say, oh, okay, life happens.
What do I do now? Right.
It was no one's fault. There's no big plan that I have to fit this into. It just is. It is what it is. And it allows you to deal with things at face value. Take it as it comes. My good friend, Cass Midgley, who has a podcast, that he did for years. He likes to say yes to what is. It just is. So I can say yes to it. And so I could have either gotten into a depression or gotten angry about the ALS diet, or just say, okay, this is what it is. Now, what am I going to do with it?
Right. And you have turned it into a magnificent, and I know it's fun. It is fun to hear that it's just been an organic experience for you, and it makes sense. And it's, but it's so great that you've grabbed onto that and you've given that to other people and given of yourself. And I think that's fantastic. And your message is great. And I'm sorry that you have to go through this experience, but if you have to, at least you can give so much from that.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
So tell me, I want to make sure that people can find you and more information about you. So how do we connect up with you?
Yes, thank you. Everything happened organically. So we got a website, we have business cards, we got all the things. DaveOutloud.com is real simple. Dying Out Loud was taken, but DaveOutloud.com. And on the website are links to my Dying Out Loud Facebook page, my Patreon account if people want to support us financially. We're traveling a lot to speak to groups. A lot of the groups are small. They're secular groups. And, if you don't guilt people into giving money, there's usually not a lot of money. So we don't have the guilt factor that religion has to make people give. But a lot of the groups are small. They don't have a big budget to pay for travel costs and stuff. We don't ask for speaker's fee when we go talk. We just need travel costs covered. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times they can't really. So the Patreon help really helps us get to places that want us to come in. We try to say no to, we try to say yes to any group that asks us. I don't really care about how big it is or how many people are there or anything. If people want us to, if they want us to come talk and share our lives with them, then we want to do that. But sometimes it's just financially not feasible. Mm-hmm. So all that stuff, the Patreon, everything's on there. But the link to the website is really easy. And it's an email address that people can reach out to me. And I do respond to everyone. It takes a while sometimes, but it's important to me that anyone that reaches out with a question or a concern or a struggle, that I try to be there and get back to them. And my travel schedule's on there. We're traveling all over the country and even into Europe this year. And I love to meet people face to face who I've connected with online. And it's just such a joy. We get to do that a lot. And so to me, it's all about humans connecting with humans and being present in each other's lives and touching one another as we journey through this life. That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm trying to do. And it's very important to me.
It makes living more fun, but it also makes sense to me that it can make the dying process more comfortable and more authentic.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you. This has been fantastic. I'm hoping to, if you make it to Minnesota or I end up wherever you are, it would be fun to meet you in person. I'm just grateful for the work that you're doing. It seems so weird to just be so happy about the work that you're doing because it feels like so wrong somehow. But
I get that all the time. In fact, I joke about it a lot. I just posted a video on my Facebook page, Dying Out Loud. Yesterday was the 1-year anniversary for my diagnosis. So
I did
a little video about, fuck you ALS. And I kind of made a joke about it because I couldn't really get my hands to work right. And so I had to finagle my hands to say, fuck you. And so I joke about things. I think it makes people, initially they're uncomfortable, but it does make it easier to be around, because if I'm okay with it, it helps people around me be okay with it.
Right. Well, and I think honestly, it's an example that other people, it sort of gives people permission when they're struggling to deal with the struggle rather than the embarrassment, maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think we need more of that. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was in Minnesota last summer. I spoke at a Unitarian church there in Minneapolis.
I saw that.
But I'm not sure. Yeah, right now we don't have any plans to be back there. But you never know. I mean, we're going to be going a lot of places. So we'll
right.
see.
Well, hopefully if you come to Minnesota, you come during the summer again, because winter is no fun.
No, I don't want to do that.
No, you don't. All right. Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and I wish you all the best.
Okay. Thank you, Judy. My pleasure.
Thank you. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There are so many things that stand out in this conversation. One of them that got me thinking a little bit was just the concept of purpose, where he talks about how this work that he's doing gives him a sense of purpose and an energy. And it makes so much sense to me. And I'm glad that he has found this. And what a great way to spend this last period of your life doing something that has such great effect and inspiration on people, and to be wanted to come talk, be in our space and have these conversations. What a very cool experience. Wouldn't it be nice if we could all find that as we move through life and get to experience that in such a true and deep way? I don't know. I have this like concept that I want to like download into everybody's brains to help me sort out what I'm trying to think and figure out how to put words to it. And what does one do with that information? How do we help people and ourselves? How do we help us find that purpose where we're living that purpose-driven life that gets us up every day? And I'm excited for him that he has this constant feedback coming at him. And what a fun thing to have and experience. And purpose and pleasure and all of those things are very different for each of us. So, of course, that's going to look different for everybody. But we get caught up in our daily life and the minutiae of everything and just trying to survive and, right, like make sure all of the stuff gets done and the people get where they need to go and the food gets on the table and we take care of ourselves, that sometimes the purpose piece can be a real challenge. So I applaud him for finding that space and having it come so naturally out of everything that he's doing. What a lovely, lovely experience. As usual, you will find his information and the things that we talked about in the show notes. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Thank you so much for listening. Please do share this podcast episode with anybody that you think might be interested or find it helpful. And I thank you for supporting the podcast in that way. And of course, you can check out Patreon, where you can find both Dave's page and the Wellness Renaissance page. We both greatly appreciate your support that helps us make things possible and keeps things going. So thank you very much. Connect with me at wellnessrenpodcast.com, where you can find all the other episodes. Send an email, leave comments on this episode. You can also, of course, find the Wellness Renaissance Facebook page. Have a wonderful week, and may you continue to find the pieces that fit beautifully and with purpose into your health and wellness puzzle. See you next time.